This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara coming to you from Gadigal land. This Wednesday, the latest signs of a slowing economy. Is it a warning for households already struggling with rising costs? Australia and the US invite more cooperation with Japan to counter the rise of China. And an extraordinary discovery with a near complete fossil of a long lost giant unearthed in Western Queensland.
We've been looking for, well, not just myself, but people before me as well. I've also been trying to find such a find for many, many, many years because they're pretty hard to come by.
First today, Australia and the United States have agreed on a plan to boost military cooperation with Japan as they look to counter China's influence in the Pacific. The announcement comes after a meeting in Washington this morning between Australia's ministers for defence and foreign affairs and their US counterparts. The plan includes an invitation for Japan to participate in more joint defence exercises. David Sparks has more.
It was the first meeting between the US and Australia's defence and foreign affairs chiefs since the Albanese government came to power, and there was a lot to talk about. On the Australian side, Ministers Penny Wong and Richard Marles, and on the American side, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and Defence Secretary Lloyd Austin. When they walked out of the meeting, there were all the usual declarations of friendship and cooperation, but Richard Marles was particularly happy with an agreement to boost cooperation with Japan.
As Secretary Austin also pointed out, it's really important that we are doing this from the point of view of providing balance within our region and involving other countries within our region. And we look forward to being able to have more engagement with Japan in terms of that force posture cooperation. Later this week, the Foreign Minister and I will be in Tokyo conducting our 2+2 meeting with Japan. And it is a great outcome of today's meeting that we can go to Japan at the end of this week with an invitation for Japan to be participating in more exercises with Australia and the United States.
US Defence Secretary Austin says it's about bringing Japan into America's defence strategy for the region.
China's dangerous and coercive actions throughout the Indo-Pacific, including around Taiwan, toward the Pacific Island countries, and in the East and South China Seas, threaten regional peace and stability. And meanwhile, Russia's cruel and unprovoked invasion of Ukraine is also an attack on the rules-based international order that makes countries everywhere more secure. In the face of these challenges, the United States and Australia stand united and determined to be a force for stability and to work with like-minded partners for a free and open Indo-Pacific.
Analyst Tom Corbin from the United States Studies Center at Sydney University says the plan to expand cooperation with Japan is in keeping with a long-term trend.
Exactly what this might look like is a little bit unclear. This could look like greater Japanese participation in a wider range of exercises that Australia and the US hold in Australia, but it could also mean more regular rotations of Japanese troops on longer-term postings. But this tracks quite clearly with things that the Japanese ambassador to Australia, Yamagami Shingo, has been saying for the last couple of months about Japan's desire to be more involved with Australia and US initiatives in Australia.
Today's meeting wasn't only about military engagement. Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong says they made progress in other areas. She says her focus for the US relationship emphasises three main areas: action on climate change, engagement with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, and engagement with the Pacific.
We're working with the US on initiatives such as the Partners in the Blue Pacific Initiative, to the funding for an increased disaster risk reduction, including through pre-positioning of responses to humanitarian disasters, and the offer from the US Coast Guard to participate in the Maritime Security Program. Maritime security being such an important part of the Pacific's interests.
Tom Corbin says Foreign Minister Wong is sending a clear signal.
What I took from Penny Wong's emphasis on these three new pillars or three new focus areas for alliance cooperation was twofold. So the first was to stamp the new Australian government's mark or symbol on its engagement with the United States at kind of the pinnacle of the alliance's engagement, if you will, but also because there's quite a receptive audience within the Biden administration and within Washington more broadly to Australia's prerogatives and to these three areas in particular. So climate change, for example, which was the first pillar that Penny Wong identified as a new pillar for alliance cooperation, is a prerogative for both parties at home and abroad in Australia and the United States alike.
The leaders also discussed assistance for Ukraine in its defence against the Russian invasion and plans for Australia to purchase nuclear-powered submarines under the AUKUS agreement.
That's David Sparks reporting there. Well, back home now, and Australia's economy remains resilient despite 8 consecutive interest rate rises to tame runaway inflation. But there are clear signs that the economy is starting to slow as the lagging impact of rate rises and global uncertainty starts to bite into household budgets. For more, I'm joined now by our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, what do these figures tell us about the strength of the economy despite inflation and rate rises?
Well, Sally, these official figures from the Bureau of Statistics show an economy that's still growing and still resilient. But yes, we are seeing a softening below forecasts and a few scratches are becoming visible, up 0.6% in the September quarter. That's the fourth consecutive quarter of growth after a contraction in September last year that makes 5.9% over the 12 months. That higher than usual 5.9% annual figure is because of the surge we saw over the 12 months after the lockdowns ended this time last year. Borders reopened and supply chain pressures eased. Also, pent-up consumers went out shopping and spent up big. As I mentioned, some signs of an economic softening. The terms of trade are down by 6.6%. Weaker overseas demand for iron ore and coal prices are falling from record highs in previous quarters. Also, household savings are lower, 6.9% in the quarter, down from 8.5% as budgets tighten from higher interest rates and soaring energy prices. But it is important to remember these numbers are backwards looking. A lot of water has gone under the bridge locally and globally since then. And now the focus is on how Australia fares with the big challenges of the highest interest rates in 10 years and surging inflation and a possible downturn in Australia's real estate market.
Peter, given the slowing, what are the risks of Australia falling into a recession?
Well, both our Treasury and the Reserve Bank still see economic growth next year, but seeing it falling down to perhaps 1.5%. The impact of more interest rate rises from the Reserve Bank will be critical next year, and a hard economic landing remains a big risk. AMP economist Deanna Messina says with the United States on the brink of recession, the risk of a recession here in Australia can't be ruled out.
I think it's a high risk, and all of the leading indicators in the US are pointing to a recession. Leading economic indicators are at recessionary-like levels in the US as well. Australia so far has not been hit as much, despite having very aggressive interest rate rises, which has helped consumer purchasing power. So that should help us avoid a recession. But the risk of a recession is still very high in the next 12 months, probably at about 30 or 40%.
That's AMP economist Deanna Messina there. Peter, Treasurer Jim Chalmers has been gloomy to date about the economic risks. How has he reacted to the GDP outcome?
Well, Sally, Jim Chalmers remains cautious and positive. He's been really managing expectations, as we've seen over the last few months. He says, though, these figures show the economy has performed solidly in the face of steep economic headwinds from overseas. Once again, Dr. Chalmers noted the outcome is backwards looking, but says the uncertainties are ahead of us, not behind us, especially if the United States and also Europe go into recession. He's pointed to the October budget being a responsible document, starting the beginning of a budget repair, but Sally, really battening down the hatches for what's going to be quite a tough 2023.
Peter Ryan, thank you. You're listening to The World Today. COVID cases have doubled in the Northern Territory in the past week, rising faster than anywhere else in the country. The Chief Minister says the NT has moved out of the COVID emergency phase, but Aboriginal healthcare providers say that call is premature. As Angus Randall reports, health services are very worried about a Christmas peak.
The Northern Territory recently recorded a worrying COVID milestone, 100,000 cases since the start of the pandemic. Experts say that's likely an undercount, but the trend in the official numbers shows a steeper rise in the NT right now than anywhere else in Australia. John Patterson is the CEO of the Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance, Northern Territory.
Up until this year, we've had 40 Aboriginal deaths in the Northern Territory. It's killing Aboriginal people at younger ages, with highest numbers of deaths in the 60 to 69 age group, and then the 50 to 59, compared with over 80 for the non-Aboriginal population. So you can see that the Aboriginal population is at most risk.
He's concerned over what will happen in the coming weeks as those in remote communities travel to more populated centres during the Christmas season.
You know, it's unfortunate and I think premature that governments are taking their foot off the pedal here and not giving it as much attention as it deserves, given that we're starting to now see a rise on the numbers again. Our advice would have been, look, just wait until after the Christmas New Year period to see what the numbers were like, and we would reconsider any other public measures that we may need to take during that period.
According to the NT government's figures, over 94% of Territorians have had their second COVID vaccine, but that drops to 81% in remote communities. John Patterson says it remains difficult to get public health information out to some of Australia's most remote places.
You know, we've obviously expended all the funding allocations during the peak of the COVID, so we're actually in desperate need of additional funding to start up a new campaign to get those critical messages in language.
Beyond the vaccination campaign, there are unique challenges when it comes to stopping the spread in the NT. Professor Catherine Bennett is the Chair of Epidemiology at Deakin University.
When the Doherty Institute and the collaboration did the modelling for the Australian roadmap for opening up the international borders, their conclusion was, with the way people mix in community, that actually can put people at higher risk because there's such strong social connection, and that can actually increase the mixing and therefore increase the risk of transmission.
There are currently no restrictions in place in the Northern Territory for those who test positive to COVID. Chief Minister Natasha Files says the raw case numbers don't tell the whole story.
Looking at last week's case numbers, they were quite high, but we did have over 200 of those cases where people that were tested and were not able to leave one of the cruise ships in Darwin. So we did still see a spike in numbers. We were warned by our health officials that we would see this wave about now, but we do have antiviral medication and vaccine, which are really important tools.
She says the NT healthcare system is ready to deal with an increase in cases.
So we certainly have kept COVID resources. We are trying to step from an emergency phase to a community phase, but we certainly have COVID resources within our health system.
New COVID figures will be released on Friday.
That's Angus Randall reporting there. Human rights groups are lamenting the passage of Indonesia's new criminal code, saying it's a significant blow to two decades of hard-won democratic rights and freedoms. The new code, passed after years of protests and debate, imposes harsh penalties for premarital sex or cohabitation and significantly curbs the right to free speech. Critics say it marks a draconian shift towards religious conservatism in the world's third biggest democracy, as Indonesia correspondent Ann Barker reports.
The new laws are far-reaching and will arguably restrict the privacy and freedoms of millions of Indonesians as well as foreigners in the country. Couples without formal marriage certificates, including those in the gay and lesbian community, could be jailed if their families choose to report them. Those caught having sex outside marriage could be jailed for up to a year. Most of the headlines have focused on what the laws mean for tourists, including Australians, in places like Bali. But it's Indonesians who'll be most affected because prosecution relies on a family complaint to Indonesian police, says Simon Butt, a professor of Indonesian law at Sydney University.
Police aren't going to be going around knocking on doors of random tourists in Bali seeking a conviction. You need to, if you're married, be reported by your spouse for having an extramarital affair. And if you're unmarried, you know, your parents need really to report you, complain about you.
But some of the harshest measures relate to freedom of speech. blasphemy laws have been strengthened, and anyone found to have insulted the president or government ministers or state institutions, including police, could face jail terms of up to 4 years. That's a law that existed before under the authoritarian Suharto regime, but was removed, and Professor Butt says it's now being restored.
Essentially, there are a whole lot of provisions in the code now that seem to contribute to the decline of democracy in Indonesia, which has allowed public figures and private figures, in fact, to silence legitimate criticism through threats of criminal prosecutions.
Criticism has come from a broad cross-section of society. Business leaders say the new penal code will deter investment and tourism at a time the Indonesian economy is just bouncing back from the pandemic. One advisory organisation, Bauer Group Asia, says the change is driven by the growing movement of religious conservatism in Indonesian politics and the government's zeal to restrict public criticism. Amnesty International says the laws give those in power authority to suppress opinions.
The new criminal code is death knell for democracy in Indonesia.
Veronica Koman is Amnesty's representative in Australia.
Indonesia is the largest democracy in the region. Like, this is also the same law came into force in Hong Kong, and now we are seeing it creeping into Indonesia.
The new laws don't take effect for up to 3 years, and experts predict they'll inevitably be challenged in Indonesia's constitutional court.
That's our Indonesia correspondent, Anne Barker. Donald Trump's business, Trump Organization, has been convicted of tax fraud in New York. The court found the company paid the personal expenses of its top executives without reporting the income. The case is one of a number of potential legal problems for the former president, who's planning to run for the White House again in 2024. Richard Painter is professor of law at the University of Minnesota and was a White House ethics lawyer under President George W. Bush.
This is a very significant decision that the Trump Organization is guilty on all counts of tax fraud. And now the question is Donald Trump himself. There was evidence introduced at trial that he knew of the tax fraud and authorized it. Can he be criminally charged and convicted for the same tax fraud? And he certainly has exposure to such a criminal case.
Do you think it's likely?
Well, we'll see what the prosecutors do. There was evidence introduced at trial that he knew full well what was going on, and he approved it. So there is strong evidence that Donald Trump himself not only authorized but participated in the tax fraud for which the Trump Organization was found guilty today.
Can you explain to us how this fits into other potential legal actions that Donald Trump may face? Because there's been a lot going on, hasn't there?
There certainly has been a lot going on with respect to Donald Trump and his legal exposure, which ranges from the investigation by the Justice Department of the insurrection in January 6 and the attempt to reverse the results of the election, which I believe almost certainly violated our criminal sedition laws. And the former president certainly has exposure for prosecution. We also have solicitation of election fraud in Georgia in violation of Georgia state law and also federal law. And that investigation is going on in Fulton County, Georgia, and the grand jury is hearing testimony. President Trump has a significant exposure to other criminal charges as well, including obstruction of justice while he was president, coercion of political activity on the part of his subordinates, ordering his subordinates to support his political campaign, which is a felony in the United States. And he has some very, very significant legal problems right now.
How significant does a criminal conviction need to be to knock someone out as a potential candidate to become president?
Well, if Donald Trump is convicted of sedition or insurrection, the most serious charge in connection with the attempt to overturn the 2020 election, he would automatically be disqualified under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, Section 3. With respect to the other criminal charges or convictions, they would not be disqualifying on their face under our Constitution. But voters are already very, very sick of Donald Trump. His candidates have been losing elections right and left in the races for the House and Senate. And I believe most American voters want to move on.
From your legal perspective, which aspect of this whole story of Donald Trump's legal exposure, which aspect of that is vitally important but isn't getting the coverage that it perhaps deserves?
Well, there's been a common thread here for Donald Trump and some other members of his family for several decades. And I wrote an op-ed about this in Newsweek about 2 years ago about their business practices, which are a combination of tax avoidance, which is technically legal, and tax evasion, which is criminal. It's a practice that some London economists back in the 1970s called tax avoidance, half evasion, half avoidance. And he's been doing this. The Trump Organization has been doing it. He takes the same approach to the law and brings it into the government. And the way he coerces political subordinates to support him politically in his campaign, the way he took foreign government payments in violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, the obstruction of justice, the list of offenses goes on and on, leading all the way up to the attempt to overturn the 2020 election. And this is what I've called democracy avoidance. He really doesn't want to operate within the rules of a representative democracy any more than he wants to pay taxes.
That's Richard Painter there, Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota. He was also White House ethics lawyer under President George W. Bush. Finally today, Outback Queensland has delivered another rare fossil discovery with Australia's first complete elasmosaur skeleton. A property owner uncovered the ancient marine reptile that's a type of plesiosaur near the remote Queensland town of McKinlay. They called in the experts to carefully reveal the precious find, as Stephanie Smale reports.
Espen Knudsen has waited a long time to get the chance to dig up a whole elasmosaur skeleton.
We've been sort of been looking for, well, not just myself, but people before me as well. I've also been trying to find such a find for many, many, many years because they're pretty hard to come by on a globally speaking as well, not just within Queensland.
The Museum of Tropical Queensland senior paleontology curator headed to Western Queensland after a property owner spotted the first signs of the plesiosaur.
One day she sent me a photo and they'd already uncovered a lot of the skeleton, and you could easily see the head in the ground, followed by the neck and towards the rest of the body. So obviously that was a very, very good sign.
He says it's rare to find a fossil of the creature with the head still attached.
Often what you'll find with any long-necked animal in the fossil record is that you'll find bits of the body with no head, or you might be lucky and find a head without much or any of the body attached to it.
They're such bizarre animals, they're a little hard to describe.
Queensland Museum Research Assistant Christina Chiatakis helped to excavate the site. She explains elasmosaurs look like huge turtles with no shells, and this one's neck is longer than she is tall.
They've got flippers like a turtle, but they've got really, really, really long necks, like a giraffe, but instead of sitting upright, it sits down in front of it. And then they've got these tiny little tails.
The team has carefully put the individual bones in bubble wrap, plaster, and wet toilet paper and taken them to the Museum of Tropical Queensland in Townsville for further analysis. Christina Chiatakis says it's hard to tell why this plesiosaur died, but it would have been swimming around in what's now red dirt about 100 million years ago.
It is odd to think of the fact that we are finding marine reptiles and turtles and fish and that sort of thing in what is now essentially desert in outback Queensland, but back in the Cretaceous, it was an inland sea.
This really is golden age of dinosaur and marine reptile hunting in Queensland.
Queensland Museum Network Chief Executive Jim Thompson says the fossil is another invaluable insight into the past.
This joins the world up in some ways. I mean, the world looked very different 100 million years ago than it does now. And putting all these pieces together tells a really fantastic story of how the Earth has evolved.
And Espen Knudsen is hoping there's more where that came from.
There's bones coming out all over the place over there and throughout most of central and western Queensland as well. So it's certainly a place that we need to go out and see if there are things that we haven't found before. Anything's possible. Who knows what's out there?
That's Espen Knudsen from the Museum of Tropical Queensland, ending that report from Stephanie Smale and Rachel Merritt about an extraordinary discovery in outback Queensland. Well, that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. David Lipson and the PM team, they'll be along later today with the latest stories from across the country and around the world. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara. Stay safe.
I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's been such a rocky economic year, and now we've had a pre-Christmas interest rate rise, the eighth increase in a row. So what can we expect in 2023? Today, business editor Ian Verinder on why China has a lot to do with where we're heading. Keep listening to hear ABC News Daily. Find the podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.